You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from snowy Seattle, joined today by one of our favorite Third Pelton brothers, and nobody better to help us break down the end of a season than Ben Baldwin of The Athletic Seattle. Welcome back to the pod.
Thanks for having me for this time-honored tradition to speculate on which Seahawks are coming back and where we all go from here, and having them ignore a great deal of our advice, but it's fun to have these conversations.
It's funny because when you said ignore a great deal, it implied that there was some part of it that they weren't ignoring.
All right, I was trying to start off generously.
Well, we're going to prevent that because we've talked through the Packers game last night in our emergency post game pod, but you know, haven't gotten your perspective aside from on Twitter. What did you think of what we had to say in that game in general?
So I think just by disposition, I think I'm, in general, I'm similar to Kevin, and when you guys argue, I tend to agree with a lot of Kevin's takes, but not this time.
Yes, there we go.
So I was pretty, like, yeah, you can say that we shouldn't be disappointed if something happens that we should have seen coming in the first place, and I think that's understandable, but at the same time, like, the contrast between on the same day, how a team like the Chiefs uses Mahomes and really puts pieces around him, and when they need to, are willing to lean on him completely. The environment that he operates in versus what the Seahawks do with Russell Wilson, it's just so frustrating watching his age 30 season and then now his age 31 season both end in similar ways where the nobody would say that the coaches did everything they could to put the team in best position to win those games. So because of that, I know it's never going to happen, but if I read that the Seahawks decided that they were going to move in a different direction for head coach, I would not hate that at all.
It's still so tough.
You went back and forth. We were talking about this on the phone earlier today, and you flip-flopped in the course of our conversation.
Okay, so basically my thought on this is Pete Carroll may not be one of the 10 best coaches in the NFL right now, but he definitely has one of the top 10 job securities among coaches in the NFL right now. And I think that's the most important thing. Like, talking about whether the Seahawks should hypothetically move on from Pete Carroll, it almost is just like, I don't know, maybe. It doesn't really matter because it's not going to happen. Like, the reality is Pete Carroll is the Seattle Seahawks, maybe even more so than Russell Wilson is in a lot of ways, where it's like this, nobody in the front office today is having the conversation, or even above Pete Carroll, is having the conversation like, is this the right regime? Because they know it's the right regime in their minds. And so in the same way that, like, the conversation that's happening among Pete Carroll, like, after this game, is when he looks at this, he's like, well, we stopped the run, so this was a success. Like, I just don't know if they're necessarily prioritizing the same things that we're prioritizing. And they're saying the team won X mini games this year and they won a playoff game. Therefore, Pete Carroll is good. He's set. Like, I think his job security is as close to 100% as anybody's could be in the NFL. And so it's just like, I guess I couldn't say what I want them to do, but the reality is it's so far from happening that it's almost like it just, we have to remove ourselves from that conversation because it'll only lead to disappointment.
So do you think that's any different than talking about, like, fourth down decisions or how often they run the ball, given that we know that so, like, ultimately, what's the point? Why do we do any of this if we know that nothing is going to change?
Wow, welcome to Nihilistic Kevin 2020. I mean, I do, you know, I was going to get to this, and I do think there's a distinction between those two, because we have seen Pete Carroll make slight adjustments to his philosophy over the course of his time in Seattle, and certainly dramatic adjustments to his philosophy between when he was in New England and even earlier in his career, and then, you know, the success he had at USC and then with the Seahawks. So we've seen that he is willing to look inward and change things at times, although obviously that becomes less likely as you become older. I think that someone could make an uber rational argument that there is like a plausible argument that could convince Pete Carroll I should be doing things slightly different on fourth downs and in terms of run pass ratio, probably more likely the former than the latter. But I don't think that there's any argument that would appeal to Seahawks ownership and, you know, that level of authority that they need someone else on coaching this team, especially with, you know, the size of Pete Carroll's contract is another factor here.
Yeah, I definitely agree on the latter. The only reason to talk about this is a interesting exercise of if we were putting ourselves in the shoes of running the team, what would we do? And that's part of the fun of following sports is saying, what would I do in this situation? What do I think is best here? And even though in this particular situation, we know that there's 0% chance of a change, unless the only way that Pete Carroll won't be the coach in 2020 for the Seahawks is if he doesn't want to be the coach.
Exactly.
But can I offer an additional thought? Because there was an argument that we can accept that Pete Carroll is probably a below average in-game coach and then also potentially like game planner. I think it's pretty safe to say that he doesn't necessarily approach these games, especially on the defensive side, and say, okay, here's what I'm faced with and here's how I'm going to effectively attack it. Or maybe he does, but that approach just doesn't seem to work. Or his vision of how to effectively attack it isn't the right vision for winning games. And so there was an argument that basically Pete Carroll's good at everything else. And part of that is he's involved in the roster assembly of the team. But people were upset yesterday in the most important situation. The anger and vitriol that I saw, there was one individual player that took this, was Malik Turner. And the reality is, this isn't on Malik Turner. Like, Malik Turner, skill-wise, shouldn't have been in the game in that situation, right? Like, at no point, and granted, Malik Turner, I think his stats have been fairly solid this year, but roster assembly-wise, this team isn't deep enough at wide receiver. Like, that's the reality. They have Tyler Lockett and DK Metcalf. And then beyond that, it's a lot of replacement-level receivers or worse.
Well, they did try something there.
With Josh Gordon?
Yes.
Sure, but they tried something multiple years late and with a Band-Aid at best. You know, like, you couldn't have schemed your entire season and your receiver core around Josh Gordon getting released by the Patriots and then still being able to play. Like, yes, if Josh Gordon was there, maybe he makes that catch if he's in the Malik Turner role. But, like, that's just not how you can approach a team. And by consistently ignoring the wide receiver position in a lot of ways, that's why they're in this situation.
I mean, they did also draft a wide receiver in the middle rounds of this year's draft. It just turns out they're extraordinarily bad about drafting those type of wide receivers for whatever reason.
That too. But all of this is on Pete and John. Like, none of it is about anybody else. And you have to give them credit for drafting DK Metcalf because he looks like a young star. But it's like, you know, once you get deeper down, Zach tweeted about this, I think, today or yesterday, where it's basically like having the Tyler Lockett injury costs the Seahawks potentially a bye, potentially in the number one seed, and having one injury to one receiver, especially with a quarterback like Russell Wilson, shouldn't derail your entire offense that much. So it's like they needed more and they didn't have it because the picks that they have spent on receivers have largely been busts outside of DK Metcalf.
One of the arguments people made last year about why they couldn't pass the ball more was because they only had Doug Baldwin and Tyler Lockett, and then Doug Baldwin retired and they had four day one or day two picks. So they used one of those on a wide receiver, and yeah, they were very thin at wide receiver. And then we haven't even talked about pass protection, which is another thing that they don't appear to prioritize. And Russell Wilson has had very, very few even adequate pass protecting offensive lines. And we've seen Russell Okung walk with no replacement. We saw them move on from Jarry Evans after he was there in preseason, and the offensive line was again very bad this year. So if we think of like a forward-thinking organization as is knowing that passing efficiency is primarily what drives winning in the NFL in 2019, then in terms of roster construction, I don't think they've done everything they can to maximize the position that Russell Wilson is in.
Why do we think the offensive line was so much worse in 2019 than 2018? Do we think it's primarily about the injury to Justin Britt and the fact that Joey Hunt was just kind of overmatched in obvious pass rushing situations? Or do you think that there was something about the personnel that was, because it wasn't a dramatically different group of players, the only change being at left guard?
Yeah, so this is a good question. And I think in this particular one, I don't think it's fair to the Seahawks to completely blame them for the offensive line being bad this year, because we know for individuals, pass protection is one of the most stable things from year to year. And returning starters got worse at pass protection. And maybe for Dwayne Brown, we could have predicted that because he's getting old, but
yep.
DJ Fluker being a lot worse in 2019 than 2018, like, why did that happen? I don't know, but for that, you can't really blame the Seahawks. Justin Britt getting hurt is unfortunate, and then the J.R. Sweezy to all the different players they had at left guard seems like it was a pretty big downgrade, unfortunately. So I do take your point that in this particular year, it's not reasonable to cast the full blame for bad pass protection on roster construction.
Anything else we should touch on as we're looking back on 2019 as a whole that we haven't covered yet?
Let me just ask a question, which is, if you take the Seahawks aside from quarterback, what position groups are they above average at? And then what position groups are they, say, in the top 10 in the NFL at?
All right. Well, why don't we just go through position group by position group and do that then? Let's start with running backs, which they're average because all teams are the same there.
That's fair. If we want to say they're above average, that's totally fine. But in terms of how that translates into winning games, then yep.
I think they probably are a little bit above average there. But again, it's not a place that really distinguishes teams. Wide receiver group.
I would call them above average there and perhaps top 10. This is only counting the wide receivers and not the tight ends.
Right. I mean, I think given the way that DK Metcalf came on over the course of the season, like clearly they need a more reliable number three option. And I agree, as you know, you were alluding earlier, as Zach Whitman has said repeatedly on Twitter, you know, this is the year for them to go out and add another wide receiver high in the draft, given the depth of this class and the ability there. All right. Tight end group.
I think this one's, well, some of it depends on Will Disley, but he's coming off a serious injury, and while he has successfully come back from a serious injury, I don't know if this is something that we can expect to happen. So until we see that, I would say well below average / probably one of the worst in the NFL.
I mean, I think I'd probably go incomplete here just because we don't know what kind of Disley we're going to get. It's probably worth noting that when we're talking about the downgrade in terms of pass blocking from 2018 to 2019, the tight ends are probably a factor in that. Not that Disley played a lot more in 2018 than he did this season, but you did have Ed Dixon stepping in when Disley was unavailable last year. That was another injury that doesn't get talked about very much, but the fact that they got zero snaps from Ed Dixon this year was a tremendous disappointment. And, you know, I think Hollister is a blocker, is weaker than those two players, even though he did become a threat in the pass game. Offensive line?
Below average.
I concur. Defensive line.
Is this looking at 2019 or guessing what's hurt? Basically, what do we do about Clowney here?
Looking back at 2019. Yeah.
Okay. I'll say average, which might be being generous given how many games Reed and Clowney missed, but average to maybe below average.
I think the results were below average. I think on paper, this is an average team.
It's the defensive line is a really tough one because, I mean, their leading sacker had 4 sacks this year, you know? So it's tough to, like, look at that and say that this is really an average defensive line. Sacks aren't everything. Pressures matter. And Clowney missed time. Maybe at their absolute peak, they were an average defensive line. But I think for most of the season, between injuries to Onsa never really healed in a full way. We never really saw, like, a fully healthy Onsa or a fully capable Onsa. Jaren Reed wasn't the same type of player coming back from suspension. Clowney missed a bunch of time. Granted, he was amazing when he was playing, especially when he was on. But beyond that, it's just like, I don't know. We just didn't get that many sacks and that much pressure in a lot of key games.
But I think they were about average by the ESPN pass rush win rate measure. So taking that at face value, they were about average at winning in 2.5 seconds, but very below average at getting the quarterbacks, then we would think that would mean that the second was very bad at covering people and quarterbacks were just able to get the ball out of their hands quickly, which kind of checks out with how a lot of Seahawks games went.
Yeah, they were precisely 16th in the league at 43% pass rush win rate.
Wow.
Linebacker group. I think we've got to agree they're top 10 right there, right?
Yeah, in terms of talent, yes. In terms of youth, with three of them on the field at once, it's hard to disentangle those. But in terms of the actual players they have, yeah, top 10.
All right, then let's go cornerbacks and safeties separately. Cornerbacks.
So Griffin. So again, this is like the linebackers where the number of players on the field is kind of a variable here.
Right.
But in terms of how they should be playing with most snaps being in nickel defense, if we're talking about the top 3 corners on the roster, I think they're well below average.
Yeah. I mean, I think Shaquille Griffin has established himself as an above average number 1 corner at this point, but you're below average at number 2 and definitely at the nickel corner, even accounting for the usage. It's interesting. You mentioned in our DM kind of setting this up this morning that when we were doing the same podcast a year ago and we're talking about potential free agents, we were all very okay with the Seahawks letting Justin Coleman go, expecting that he would be among the highest paid nickel backs in the league as Detroit ended up making him this year. And it seems like that's a deal that didn't work out for either side because Coleman was a disappointment for the Lions, but also the Seahawks were never really able to find a quality replacement for him.
Yeah, I think we were thinking that, oh, it's Pete Carroll to coach up a defensive back and it's just the slot corner anyway, so they'll be okay. So not paying that much makes sense. But if we had known that the solution would be to put a third linebacker on the field, then maybe we would have felt differently about paying Justin Coleman.
Right. I mean, I do think Ugo Amadi showed signs over the course of the season of developing into that. I feel like going forward by the end of next year, he could be, you know, an above average nickel corner. But this year, he wasn't quite at that point. Safety, then.
I think above average when Diggs and McDougal are both on the field.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Possibly top 10 with that combo.
Man, so, okay, let me just summarize here then. Basically, we're saying above average at running back, potentially top 10 at receiver, below average at O-line, average on D-line, top 10 at linebacker, top 10 at safety potentially, and above average at corner. That's a pretty good team, right? Really?
Average at corner.
Or average at corner and then potentially top 10 at safety. Like, yeah. All things considered, if you were to take almost any team in the league, especially in the situation that the Seahawks are in with having to pay a quarterback, you know, they're not a team that has like a quarterback on a rookie deal or something like that. Like, why then? I suppose this is an argument pro the Pete and John roster assembly. Like, they've taken one of the most difficult situations in the league to be in, which is having the highest paid quarterback in the league, and they've turned it into a pretty good roster around him. Why then do I
mean, I wouldn't say it's that difficult of a situation to be in. It's still a good situation to have that good of a quarterback, but your point is taken.
But you understand what I'm saying. Why then do I see, and granted, I don't want to mention this person's name, but do I see a tweet and they say that without Russell Wilson, the Seahawks are a 4-12 team? And I say to myself, that checks out.
Yeah, I think it does check out.
Well, it depends who you're replacing Russell Wilson out with, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like, if Russell Wilson gets injured, yeah, they're a 4-12 team. But who was a dead average quarterback this season?
Ryan Fitzpatrick.
I can't say the first name that came to mind. Jameis Winston?
I mean, with Jameis Winston, I think they're a 7. They're an 8-8 team, probably. They're still playing a lot of close games, and a lot of them are ending in Jameis Winston interceptions.
How many games did the Buccaneers win?
7, I think. I think they're 7-9. Okay, so then a follow-up question to this is, if all of these things are true, the Seahawks have the top 10 quarterback, top 5 quarterback, whatever. I'm not going to risk this again. If the Seahawks have a number 1 quarterback in the league, there's not going to be a year-end pod where I'm saying that Russell Wilson is anything less than the best quarterback in the league. But plus all of these above-average position groups and top 10 position groups, why then did they spend 62% of the time this season trailing?
I mean, that's where I think it does point to the in-game coaching and the philosophies of the coaching
like
staff.
At every position, aside from maybe a couple, and even the offensive line is not terrible, right? Like, they're not the worst offensive line group in the league.
Like, we were generally doing this agnostic to injuries, I think, and definitely the Seahawks had above average injuries this season. They were unlucky in terms of injuries.
And I think the offensive line this year was legitimately terrible, I think.
And the tight end group got extremely bad because of injuries. We said that they were probably below average, but, you know, they had the chance to be much better if not for injuries. The safety group wasn't a top 10 group all season because Quandre Diggs only played, what, 6 games plus the 2 playoff games?
Yeah, McDougal missed time too, I think. And how many games of Tedrick Thompson did they have out there?
Oh, God.
Too many.
Then basically, like, if this is the case, if the Seahawks were sort of ravaged by injuries at a lot of key position groups, but in general, sort of like neutrally, you know, in Madden or whatever going into the season, they have a fairly good team. And you look at somebody like the Packers, who on the broadcast yesterday, they're like, you know, the Packers have largely been unaffected by injuries, which is why when you ask the question, how did the Packers get to 13-3? Maybe that's the answer. Is this not a defense of Pete Carroll and his both roster assembly and maybe even some in-game coaching?
You mean an indictment?
No. Like, he managed to get to this place to what were they, 11-5, 12-4? They managed to 11-5 and win a playoff game while being ravaged by injuries at key positions and still got this far.
Did you just flip-flop on Pete again?
No, I'm saying there are other ways to look at it, is that I think maybe that we're judging. You know, it's like the Vikings game that happened on Saturday against the 49ers. Immediately after it, Kevin Stefanski gets announced as the head coach of the Browns. And everybody's like, well, he was so terrible yesterday. Like, why would they announce him as their coach? As if it wasn't, A, already done before then. And B, it was one fucking game, right? Like, Kevin Stefanski, in general, is probably a good offensive coordinator for the duration of the season. And you're just like, well, why didn't you hire the defensive coordinator who shut down his team? As if it's that simple. And granted, maybe they should have. But, like, are we just judging Pete Carroll a little bit too much from recency bias of he was going into a game in Green Bay that it was a very difficult game against an extremely healthy Packers team at their home? And then also coming off a season where, you know, like, Jadeveon Clowney missed a bunch. Their most important defensive player, maybe aside from Bobby Wagner, missed a bunch of time. And Quandre Diggs, who they made a good move by trading for midseason, then immediately ends up getting injured. Or, like, you know, Dwayne Brown misses time. Like, do they win that Cardinals game if Dwayne Brown is there? Just, I feel like maybe there are these small differences that are making us judge Pete Carroll a little bit too harshly.
So I don't think it's just reaction to one game, because a lot of the frustrations that many fans have with Pete Carroll are things that happened over the course of the season, as discussed on this podcast many times. So the punting on 4th-and-1 in opponent territory, the not putting the ball in Russell's hands until forced to, like, all these things are, and not even just this season, things that have been going for a long time.
Yeah, I thought at some point you were going to bring up the stat about Russell Wilson's QBR and playoff losses in his career.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and like it's not all on coaching that the Seahawks fall behind in these divisional round games. Like there has to be it can't just be that the coaches are telling the players to not try in the second half. Like it's not it seems like that's what's happening, but it's not actually what's happening. And going back to the record, a lot of that is just getting lucky in one score games, and we know that from previous Russell Wilson and Pete Carroll seasons, there's no reason to expect that going forward. So if we say that Pete Carroll did a good coaching job because they went 11-5 with all these injuries, even if they're a lot healthier next year, we shouldn't expect them to win that many games.
Well, although in DVOA they were better, and yeah, it's like
if they were they finished 8th or something in DVOA, right?
I believe 9th, but 7th in weighted DVOA. They finished just ahead of they flip flopped ahead of Dallas and Minnesota in weighted DVOA because obviously those three teams have to be back to back to back because they are the same team.
It's a strange situation. How would you feel, Ben, about somebody like Matt LaFleur? Like, it's your perspective. I might guess what it is based upon the quarterback that he's working with. Let's say that today you swapped Pete Carroll and Matt LaFleur as the coach of the Seahawks.
Oh, I'd be so happy. So he's the Packers throw the ball on early downs at a very high rate. Their offense seems like it's well designed. They got the Seahawks into a lot of coverage busts and things that it doesn't feel like the Seahawks are able to do for Russell Wilson. And the great unknown is how he would do if he didn't have such a ton of offensive line, which really makes it easier for play callers because it opens a lot of doors. And you know that your especially tackles are going to build up. He didn't have to deal with as many issues as Schottenheimer did this year, but at this point, I just want to see what Russell Wilson could do when he's actually allowed to throw on early downs at a high rate and has kind of these man in motion, kind of innovative offenses that we really haven't seen.
God, the pre-snap motion in that game yesterday. It was just like the Seahawks are like fucking Easter Island before every snap. And the Packers.
That's fair. They were moving around to try. They will move around to try to diagnose man versus zone. They will have preset motion. It's just not motion at the time of the snap that they don't
have. Well, and the Packers have so much motion. When you watch an offense like the Niners, and you're just like, this is a really hard offense to play against.
And the message from that Seth Walder piece of ESPN on the pre-snap motion thing was that there's no evidence of any advantage to the offense if you're just motioning someone out to identify coverage and then you step before the snap. The real advantage is if someone's moving at the snap, because then you're putting trust in the defense to make these quick in the moment decisions, and that's when breakdowns happen. And that's what the Seahawks just don't make a concerted effort to do.
Well, and that seems to be like, I think what we've understood the most about football or come to understand the most about football in the last 5 seasons or something like that, is that's why play action works. That's why the pre-snap motion works when it's at the snap, is anything that you can do to get the defense be moving in the wrong direction that you want them to be right when the play is happening is the most important thing you can do as an offense. And that's what Kyle Shanahan is so good at.
Make them think, make them hesitate, make them not sure what's coming. Anything other than just line up and wait 15 seconds and then run your play and hope that you out-execute the other team.
Like, do we think, and I don't know where the Niners offense ranked in DVOA necessarily, but like, do we think that the Niners have more talent than the Seahawks on offense at almost any position?
Well,
aside from tight end.
Yeah.
And their offensive line's probably better because they're one of 28 teams with a better offensive line, but not a quarterback or wide receiver.
They finished
or even running back
in like offensive DVOA.
I mean, we talk Raheem Mostert gets all this credit and he looks like a good running back, but like these running backs are running through massive holes, you know, like Chris Carson could be, and Grant Chris Carson has gotten a lot of credit throughout his career, but like he could easily be Raheem Mostert. And you know, like the running back group that they have, I don't look at them and say like these are talents that exceed what a normal running back looks like. It just feels
like
putting them
in. Have you heard about Kyle Juszczyk?
Oh, God.
Aren't you familiar with the engine of their offense?
Lightning rod of their offense. So anyway, I've presented all sides here because I just have. Look, whatever history wants to write, I want to be on the right side. No, I'm saying that there are different ways to look at it, and that's what makes it such a difficult thing. And I think for people to be like, yes, the Seahawks would be better off without Pete Carroll, or, you know, no. I think the main thing is, like, it would just be so much fun to see Russell Wilson in an offense where they were doing stuff like that, where there were players moving at the snap, you know, and then they're running play action extremely often. Basically, it's like, it would be fun to see Russell Wilson with their fourth quarter offense from the very beginning. If they were down 62% of the time in games and won 11 games, that means that Russell Wilson, this to me, what that translates to is everybody on the roster or whatever, most notably the coaching staff, was holding Russell Wilson back for three quarters and then saying, okay, now we're going to run the good offense when we want Russ to win the game. And it's like, if you can just run the good offense from the very first drive, like, I don't believe that anything that happened in those first three quarters sets them up better to run the good offense in the fourth quarter.
I agree with that. And football people would not agree with that, but I do agree.
And there's nothing statistically to back up what the football people would say.
That is accurate.
All right, one more question before we turn our attention to 2020. If the Seahawks brought back this exact same roster, you know, granting the injuries that are already there, but, you know, assuming that players generally heal as expected, what record would you expect from them in 2020?
I would give a best guess of either 9-7 or 10-6, probably 9-7.
I think I'm looking for 10-6.
I feel like they're in the same range that they're at, anywhere between 9-12 wins, you know? Like, it's not one of the best rosters in the league, but we did go through it, and they have the most important piece plus a lot of very good players at a lot of different positions. And, you know, their point differential wasn't as good as their DVOA was this year, but, like, their expected wins or whatever by DVOA is probably going to be in the 10.5 range.
Yeah, I think it was close to 11.
Yeah, Green Bay overachieved more in that regard since they had the weaker DVOA.
Yeah, Green Bay had so that's the other thing is Seattle had the second hardest schedule, as you guys mentioned, and that probably won't repeat. Like, maybe the Rams and the 49ers will still be good, but some of the other teams they played that were really good might not be. And I think they play the AFC East next year, so that'll be nice.
Always the Patriots in election years.
Oh, God.
Yeah. The AFC East might not be bad next year. I mean, the Dolphins certainly improved over the course of the season. The Jets can't possibly stay this bad. They've got some young teams that do seem likely to improve. But yeah, I think the odds are they won't quite have as difficult a schedule. That's one reason why I say 10-6.
We've said this every year about the AFC East. Don't forget this.
Fair.
Literally every year. But also, the AFC North wasn't, like, top to bottom that good of a division that they played. There was one really good team, and then the worst team in the NFL, and then a couple of average teams in between.
True.
Which is probably, like, what you would expect.
It was much more about their NFC schedule this year.
But that is the thing. Like, the Seahawks won 11 games with the second hardest schedule in the league.
Let's look ahead to 2020. The Seahawks will enter the offseason with approximately $60 million in cap space, maybe able to add to a little bit. But as we traditionally do, go through the key free agents and say whether we think they'll be back or not, starting with Jadeveon Clown.
I think this is hard, but it's kind of a situation of the Seahawks versus the field, because presumably he's going to hit unrestricted free agency and I'll just take the field and say that someone else will pony up more money than the Seahawks will for him.
I'm going to say in.
I also am going to say in. I think they've got so much money and they have to do something with it. He was so important to the defense that I think they will find a way. It was interesting that he said, I wanted to go to a contender. And not stay with a contender. That was an interesting construction of phrasing there. But how many teams that are going to give him are going to give him both the kind of money that I think the Seahawks will be able to offer, and you know the quality of team? I don't think it's that many.
What is the maximum average per year that you'd be willing to pay for Clowney before you would walk away? Let's say it's a 4-year deal.
What did Frank Clark get again? 5 years, $105.5 million, $63.5 million guaranteed.
Yeah. So would you do that if that was on the table for Clowney?
100%.
Yeah, Clowney's better and I think also younger than Clark was last year. So I think the answer is yes.
Wow. Man, Jadeveon Clowney is so young. I think the Seahawks would do that and fully guarantee it.
I think I would do that too.
Oh, that is not true, by the way. He's 4 months younger than Frank Clark, so he's 8 months younger.
But still, he's been in the league longer than Frank Clark, but is shockingly young.
Yes. Jaron Reed coming off a disappointment season that, of course, began with his NFL suspension related to a domestic violence incident from a few years ago.
I think he's in, and this season cost him a ton of money, but I think the Seahawks would bring him back.
I'll go with the same. And
yeah, I think I tend to agree. I think that the market will not be kind to him, and because of that, that the Seahawks will have the ability to retain him and still play Clowney. Jermaine Effetti, whose fifth-year option was declined on his rookie contract.
I think if they were going to bring him back, they probably would have picked up the option, and it doesn't really sound like there's been anything on even talking to him, so I'm going to go.
How much would that fifth-year option have been for?
I think so. That's a good point, and I think it was a lot. I think it was like 13 right. or something.
Oh my god!
So it's only guaranteed, you know, for injury, but that's you know that would be the reason to pick it up is because of the fact that you know you could still waive him, but there is the risk then that he picks up some minor injury and they then have to pay that money. So.
Man, Effetti's a tough one.
$10.3 million was the option.
I could definitely see a team, I don't want to say falling in love with Jermaine Effetti, but talking themselves into paying him.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I'm going to say that he's in, though. I think the Seahawks will want to prioritize continuity on the line.
Yeah, that's something that Pete Carroll mentioned in his season-end press conference. Another interesting thing that got mentioned today was George Fant said that his priority in free agency will be going to a place where he has a chance to start. And you know, a follow-up question someone asked him, is that the Seahawks? And he said, we'll see. So whether they considered Fant as a possible replacement to Effetti, I think affects this decision. But ultimately, I'm going to go in for Effetti, which is a lot of guys coming back so far. Mike Iupati.
I'll go with out. He wasn't that good, and he got injured a lot. And I think he's older anyway.
32, yeah.
Yeah, I'm gonna say out. I think they'll want to find a more long-term solution here.
Agreed on that. Also, be interesting to see what they think they're gonna do with Jamarco Jones, who played that left guard spot when Effetti was injured until he left the Packers game with a concussion. He was drafted, I think, with the idea of making him a left tackle, but. You know, then is Fant the replacement for Dwayne Brown? You have to be thinking about Dwayne Brown's replacement given his age. Is that Jamarco Jones? Kind of, again, some things that kind of work in concert there since Dwayne Brown is going to be 35 by the start of the 2020 season. Michael Kendricks.
This one's hard, but it seems like the Seahawks like him, and I don't know how much interest he'll have from other teams given all the off-field stuff. So I will say in without feeling strongly about it.
I'm going to say out for Kendricks, just in an interest to, seems like they feel pretty comfortable with Cody Barton there. And no matter what, Cody Barton is going to be cheaper than Kendricks is going to come back for, and could see them just looking toward the future with Cody Barton.
Yeah. So we'll see his scheduling for insider trading now set for February after being delayed several times, of course, also coming off a torn ACL. I think he's in, but that's related to something we're going to get to later.
Oh, hello.
That's not hello. Ezekiel Ansah.
Goodbye.
Yeah, pretty hard out.
Okay. We'll go through with you.
I wouldn't be shocked if Ziggy Ansah was not in the NFL next year.
I think he'll be the NFL, but I think it'll probably be more of a make good deal than this was. Next up, let's go directly to the potential cap casualties, starting sadly with KJ Wright.
So what's the dead money / savings if they move on from him?
They would save $6 million by moving on. They have $2.5 million in dead money if he's cut before June 1st.
Yeah, that's hard. Feels like I'm saying everyone is going to stay, which is obviously not going to age well, but given that they have so much cap space and aren't really spending it on, well, we'll see what they spend it on, but I'll say in.
He's in. This would just be as a potential release, right?
Yes.
He's in.
I think maybe out. I don't know. I thought Wright had a good season, but the possibility of being able to re-sign Kendrick's cheap and having Barton, you know, fill that Wright void, I think this is one they're going to look hard at. Next up is Justin Britt, who missed the end of the season due to injuries we talked about earlier. That would save $8.75 million with a little less than $3 million in dead money. He would currently scheduled to count $11.7 million against the cap in 2020.
So if he had stayed healthy this season and the season had played out, I probably would have said they would move on from him. But the watching his backups get pushed over and over again make me kind of question that. I'll say in, and there's just so many moving pieces to the offensive line that all of these are very hard to predict.
Sure, we'll say in for Justin Britt.
I wonder if they maybe look to restructure this a little bit and decrease his cap number this year and, you know, give him a little bit more long-term security. But, yeah, I think he'll be back as well for the same reason. It's sort of like when a guy wins MVP because he sits out a few games and the team looks so bad without him. That sort of situation with Justin Britt. Lastly, the seemingly most certain cap cut is Ed Dixon. That would save $3.25 million. He's guaranteed a little less than $900,000 next season.
Yep. Goodbye.
RIP to the Ed Dixon era.
We had that great moment when Michael Dixon got credit for his long long catch against Detroit. But yes, he's out.
We look forward to remembering Ed Dixon when we're remembering some guys in the future.
Two more players to discuss extension candidates heading into the final year of their rookie contracts. Shaquille Griffin.
So will they?
Yeah, I guess this is will they extend him?
Yeah, I think so. They, all accounts, they like him and he had a good season. He plays an important position and they like rewarding their guys when they can. So I could definitely see that happening over the summer.
Cool. Definitely coming back and probably getting a fairly sizable extension.
One thing that could work to their benefit as they look to negotiate this because of the fact that he was, you know, not a high draft pick. He's only made $2.5 million in base in his entire career, including next season. So I think he'll be very eager to increase that next year, and I think they will extend him. The more interesting question, perhaps, is Chris Carson.
Oh, man. Well, it's the Seahawks, so I'll say they'll do it.
Oh, God. I do not think. I think they're going to let Chris Carson play out the year and figure it out from there. Especially because, you know, he's going to be coming back from injury. They're going to have to figure that out. Obviously, the Rashad Penny injury is not great. but I think that their plan still is long term for Penny to take over that job.
I tend to agree, too. I think that the other thing is, I would assume that it's pretty cheap to franchise running backs because of the fact that they're, you know, the high end market for them is not that significant. So, you know, I think that's more of a potential weapon for them with him than it is with Shaquille Griffin, where he would be paid more like an elite cornerback. So I think not extended, but maybe I'm wish casting there.
I think that they're also just Pete cares about protecting the ball so much this year. And, you know, we're not going into this offseason feeling amazing about Chris Carson. After all the fumbles in the early half of the season. So there's definitely questions about Chris Carson in general. If both Penny and Carson are healthy to begin next season, it's not 100% that Carson wins the starting job from day one. I could see Penny being the starter in week one.
is we look ahead then to the draft. The Seahawks currently scheduled to have 8 draft picks. They'll have, by virtue of losing on Sunday, the 27th overall pick in the first round, the 59th overall pick in the second round. Then they will either have the Kansas City or San Francisco second round pick from the Frank Clark trade. It's whichever is lower of those two teams. So we know that both of those are going to be among the bottom 4 picks, but will depend where those two teams finish in the playoffs. Again, not a lot of variability either way. Going by the projections from overthecap.com for compensatory picks, they'll have a 3rd round compensatory pick for Earl Thomas. They have their own 4th round pick, a 4th round compensatory pick. Then they have a pick in the 5th round. It's really unclear which, because it's not certain which they got from Pittsburgh for Nick Vannett. They also had Jacksonville's 5th round pick, having picked up that up in a preseason trade. And then it wasn't firmly established which of those 3 potential picks, including their own, they sent to Detroit for Quandre Diggs. But suffice it to say, they have a 5th round pick and then a compensatory pick after the 6th round. So what do we see is the Seahawks' biggest needs as they look to add to the roster this offseason? And which of those do we think that they are better off trying to fill in the draft as compared to free agency?
So I think the 2-3 biggest ones are wide receiver, which we talked about, and cornerback. I think those are 2 of the biggest needs in terms of what the team needs, as well as offensive line. For offensive line, depending on what happens with Ifedi at right tackle and then Fant / Jones / Brown at left tackle, the tackles are the places where you would spend premium draft capital. And if they don't need that, then they could either draft interior line, which they need in later rounds, or go to free agency. So in terms of what I hope they do early in the draft, then wide receiver is kind of at the top of the list, and then getting help in the secondary is after that. What do you guys think?
There's so many positions. And I think first and foremost, a couple of things, a difference between, and we talked about Pete Carroll learning, right? And we talked about whether he has the potential to change. They had a time period where, for whatever reason, they just didn't prioritize getting comp picks. And then this offseason, I think they really learned from that mistake and said to themselves that comp picks are extremely valuable. You know, they waited until after the comp pick deadline to sign Ziggy Ansah. They didn't sign anybody that balanced out a comp pick this offseason, right?
They did. Mike Iupati and Jason Myers both were.
Oh, God, Jason Myers.
Yeah.
Would have really loved that field goal, Jason.
Yeah. It's a testament of how low people are at Jason Myers. Like, no one even blinked at the fact that they paid a bunch of money over the offseason for a kicker and he missed a 50-yard field goal in a playoff game. They lost by 5 points. And again, it just didn't come up.
Well, a lot happened. It was a Seahawks game. Just a lot of things are going on all the time.
That did not stop people from being upset about many things that happened in the first half.
But that field goal, you know, that could have made the 2-point conversion. You can't really do this, but could have made that 2-point conversion a chance to tie the game. But so Pete Carroll, they definitely learned from their offseason 2 years ago that they need to prioritize comp picks. And they went out and did that this offseason. So, I mean, you're talking about a 3rd-round comp pick is a pretty big asset for them to have. And when you talk about they have a good chunk of draft picks and they have a good chunk of relatively high draft picks also. You know, this isn't 8 draft picks and they're all in the 6th and 7th rounds. This is, I mean, how it's 5 picks in the first 4 rounds?
6 picks in the first 4 rounds.
6 picks in the first 4 rounds with Pete and John means that they're going to be able to do some things in the draft. And then also, I mean, you could pretty much set in stone right now, just like the Seahawks receivers pre-snap, that they're going to trade that first round pick and get more assets from it. So it's like, they're going to be maneuvering quite a bit in the early rounds of the draft and picking up a lot of players. And I do think the other positive that came out of this is, like, Pete Carroll's not happy with this team, which, for better or worse, they're not going to run it back in a lot of ways from everything we've heard today from the press conferences. But there are so many positions of need where it's like, you brought up those positions, Ben. And to me, I'm like, I mean, defensive line is, especially depending on Clowney, like, you know, pass rushing, it's pretty bleak after Clowney, you know, like does any of us feel that great about Quentin Jefferson's a free agent? Rasheem Green is.
I think Rasheem Green came on well over the course of this season.
But like, you don't go into the season saying that you have, you don't want Rasheem Green to be your second rusher. If he's a change of pace rusher, then that's great. But like, especially in this scheme, they need to be able to rush the quarterback. Cornerback, I think Ugo Amadi can potentially grow into a nickel corner, but there's still need at safety. There's still need at corner. There's need, obviously, on the offensive line at wide receiver. Just a lot of needs. But to me, I'm going to say, I think defensive line, which who knows if we have any faith in their ability to draft defensive linemen, would be one that I would really like to see them prioritize. And then also potentially another cornerback to, even if we want to talk about competition, somebody who could potentially replace Trey Flowers on the other side opposite Shaquille Griffin. So
did you see Pete Carroll's comments today about how disappointing he was that they couldn't set the edge on defense?
No, that wasn't what he said, though. He said that one of their weaknesses was being attacked on the edge. And I mean, I think that's how people interpreted it, but it also may have been a reference to the number of misdirection plays that teams were able to run on them, which, you know, I'm not sure if that necessarily has to do. I mean, I guess it's not, he's probably not blaming his linebacker core. So if that, I don't know if that's a personnel issue or an X's and O's issue.
Hopefully he doesn't think that they need to draft another LJ Collier this season.
Oh, so,
yeah, I actually kind of forgot that LJ Collier was on the roster as I was doing this until just now. Because my number one need was also going to be a defensive end. And then I would go offensive line. And I would go wide receiver third, because I think that you're in position to, and, you know, we'll see how the board falls, but you're in position to wait for kind of who the best of those guys is, maybe at the bottom of the second round.
Yeah, I realized after I gave my answer that I forgot about pass rush, and I agree that that is a high need and worth spending premium draft picks on.
I would also be interested to use a mid-round pick on a blocking tight end who, you know, can also make a play in the pass game. Someone who's, you know, a little more balanced than just going six offensive linemen all the time.
So Will Disley, basically.
Right. So, I mean, Disley became a much better pass catcher in the NFL than we anticipated. But sadly, the Seahawks don't have an eligible tight end this year, or the Huskies don't have an eligible tight end.
Is Kate Otten's coming back?
Kate Otten is coming back.
Kate Otten, just put him on the Seahawks. Like, Kate Otten will be a hell of a Seahawk when he gets there.
Okay, I wanted to wrap up by talking about something that Ben touched on Twitter in a different way than I went with it, which is Pete Carroll's been talking a lot the last day about how much this reminds him of 2012 and the disappointment of that loss to Atlanta after a furious comeback in the divisional round of the playoffs on the road with a team that narrowly lost the NFC West. And you pointed out that this is not the first time that a team has reminded Pete Carroll of 2012.
Yeah, so the earliest reference I could find was over the offseason following 2017. So that was the Great Purge, where Bevel and Cable and I can't even remember Chris Richard the defensive
Chris Richard,
coordinator?
Yeah. Yep. I had to look it up earlier when I tweeted that to Zach because I had forgotten.
So that all happened, and then Carroll doubled down on people and everything, and then came out over the summer talking about how all the youth and everything reminded him of 2012. And then Russell Wilson started repeating the same thing over the season. And then, of course, the season ended like it did with Dallas. And then again, after the game yesterday, Pete was again talking about how this reminded him of 2012 and all these players are so young and et cetera, et cetera. And if I were more well-versed in pop culture references, I'm sure there's some reference of like an old man trying to recreate the past and talking about 2012 and re-signing Marshawn Lynch, all this stuff.
But oh my God, there's actually a very perfect reference to an old man trying to recreate 2012.
So that feels where we are right now.
You're not going to say the reference?
It's Joe Biden.
Oh. Oh my God! Wow. This feels like 2012. Wow.
Some strategic gaffes at times.
It's definitely 2012 is the 95 Mariners for the Seahawks. Like, it's not even the Super Bowl season. It's 2012. because we ended that season, and like I understand what he's saying. Literally the second that that game against the Falcons was over, we were like, give us more football right now.
I watched the Pro Bowl that year. I was just that excited to watch Russell Wilson.
More than more football. I do not feel the same way, right? I mean, I would love more football, but it's just like the team is in such a different place. We're not young upstarts anymore. You know, the talent that's on the roster is not the same as that talent. Like, there were multiple Hall of Fame players entering their primes on that team. And no offense to Shaquille Griffin, but like, he's not going to be in the Hall of Fame, right? Same with Quandre Diggs. Like, Quandre Diggs, very exciting safety, but he ain't Earl Thomas. So
you said yesterday you didn't think Aaron Rodgers was going to make the Hall of Fame. So I don't know if I buy your Hall of Fame arguments right now. The thing I did look at this is I was curious just how young the Seahawks roster actually is. And I found that according to a PhillyVoice.com's analysis of post-cutdown day rosters, the Seahawks had the fourth youngest average age of the roster at 25.5. But one of the issues with that is it kind of actually is a negative indicator in terms of if you're a team that has a lot of expensive veteran stars like Russell Wilson, you're going to have to keep a lot of younger players on the back end of the roster. So then I went to Pro Football Reference and decided to weight by their approximate value stat the age of every roster in the NFL. And that came up with an average age for the Seahawks of 26.9, which was the ninth oldest in the league. Although that's a little bit unfair because approximate value is naturally dominated by quarterbacks, a position at which players age different than other positions. So then I looked at it without quarterbacks, taking them out. That drops the Seahawks down to 26.5, which is basically average. They're the 14th oldest. So it's a younger roster than it could be for a team that is, you know, on the backside of a Super Bowl appearance. But the idea that, you know, their dramatic improvement coming from within, I don't think is realistic.
Yeah, I agree with that. It seems like the thought process is we need a lot of our young players to step forward, and it's happened in the past, so therefore it's going to happen again. And that, I mean, it'd be great if that happened, but thinking that that's actually going to happen is kind of a leap.
The other thing, probably not going to be able to add prime Cliff Avril and Michael Bennett at below market rates. Yes. Inexplicably during the same offseason.
Number one in DVOA in 2012.
That is also true.
Yeah.
Number one in DVOA and added Michael Bennett and Cliff Avril. Like, there ain't no replicating 2012.
I mean, they might be able to add Michael Bennett, but it's not going to be the same Michael Bennett. God bless him.
They spent that December beating teams like 58-0 and 51, yes, whatever that Bills game was, they don't do that anymore.
Destroying the 49ers on Sunday Night Football, the biggest game in franchise history, according to Tristan. The most troubling thing about this analysis, though, is the seventh youngest roster in the league by the approximate value method belongs to the San Francisco 49ers. That's the team it might actually be 2012 for.
I think it's 2013 for the 49ers.
It very well could be. The Rams have, if you take out quarterback, the seventh oldest roster in the league. So between that and the Wade Phillips firing, maybe not feeling so great about my prediction. They were going to win the NFC West in 2020.
I think the Rams are the 2013 Niners.
Let's hope so.
The it's all about to end for the Rams. We'll see. I mean, most importantly, I think going into this offseason with Pete Carroll, who's not willing to say that his team is good enough when they're clearly not, looking to upgrade in a lot of places, having a lot of draft assets, and having a lot of money going into the offseason, being able to. This isn't a situation where Jadeveon Clowney is a free agent and they're not able to pay him what he needs. Like, they can get up to whatever number they need to get to for him. And that's a pretty exciting place to be. And still having one of, if not the best quarterback asset in the league, it's still an exciting place to be no matter what. Also ensures that we will see another 5 years of Pete Carroll.
Yep, probably. And I'm also looking forward to one of the most time-honored Pelton Cast traditions, which is spending the whole offseason speculating about who the five starters at offensive line will be.
And getting it wildly wrong. That is a time-honored Pelton cast tradition. Well, if I'm going to rationalize, much like Tristan has, to wrap up our Seahawks discussion this season, I think you made a good point earlier, Tristan, when you were talking about the Packers and how, like, basically, you know, one of the things the Seahawks have talked about is they just want to be in contention year after year. That's part of the win forever philosophy. And if you keep doing that, I think you do eventually put yourself in position. And at some point, the breaks are going to fall your way. The health is going to be on your side and not on some other team's side. And you end up with a bye in the playoffs and good things can happen. So, you know, not necessarily that we can count on that. And I think that we're going to continue to be frustrated by Pete Carroll's in-game decisions, but I don't think that will prevent the Seahawks from necessarily having more success in the playoffs in the near future. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Listening.
Thanks for joining us, Ben. And thanks for listening.